Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg, is entitled Teacher-Student Relationship in Buddhism, Part 2. The devotion students have for their teachers and teachers have for their students is the head, heart, blood, bones, and breath of the incredible gift that the Buddha Dharma is. Dharma is a living tradition that has always been passed on from teacher to student, person to person. As students, we need to hold up our end of the relationship. In this talk, we will explore some ways we can practice that prepare our minds to be receptive to and resonate with the teacher and the teachings. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. How y'all doing on this fine Sunday? Good to see you. They must be feeding you well. I believe that. So this morning, you have extra handouts, and you can take the two on paper with you if you wish, or leave them here if you wish at the end. The official title of this talk is Student-Teacher Relationship Part 2. I think it was 3 or 4 weeks ago I kind of did Part 1. Maybe it's 3 weeks ago, I guess. And because in the Vajrayana particularly, but really in all of Buddhism, having a relationship with teacher is considered to be very important. And yet, it seems that some of the realities of life in the West are different, of course, than they were in Tibet or India or Sri Lanka or where Thailand, wherever. And so it's a little different here. And then there's the translation issues about how do we understand this, and I think a lot's been misinterpreted. And we've gotten in our own way. So the first part and this are just my way of trying to actually provide some good definitions for words like devotion. What does that mean? It's a conceptual word, you know, and it's not exactly like the old Temptations song, "I second that emotion, if you feel like giving me a lifetime of devotion. I second that emotion." Do you remember that one? I don't know. Yeah, it was a good song. But we're, you know, that's sort of where our heads are at when we hear that word. And actually, what promotes a real deep experience of realization in the Dharma isn't like that. That's a profoundly dualistic way of looking at relationships. And what the Dharma is bringing us to is something non-dual. Realization is a non-dual realization. So obviously, we need to think about this a little more and not assume that we understand what's going on here. So we'll be doing that today. Also, yesterday was the 49th day since the passing of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. We obviously couldn't do anything formal here because it was Shabbat, and we don't do things here on Shabbat. But hopefully this and the Nunye retreat that's happening over at St. Martin de Porres will be an appropriate way for Columbus KTC to honor the 49th day since Rinpoche's passing. the tradition in Tibet is that you do prayer and practice in a special way for 49 days after someone passes, and it helps energize their path into whatever their next life would be. And honestly, there have been practices, it's pretty impressive, all over the world for 49 days at monasteries in Tibet and India and Nepal and here at KTD and Karmaling and other places as well for 49 days, where monastics, who really their whole job is to do practice and to teach, have devoted this to his passing. He was an extraordinarily important teacher in the world. He's responsible in many ways for, I want to say, the way Dharma rooted in the West in a healthy way. It came in all kinds of ways. He was an extraordinary teacher. And aside from my own personal connection, which I'm still a little bit tender over his passing, just to be connected to all that activity, that positive activity in this world is incredible. And just because you're here, literally in this place, in this community that he founded in 1977, you are touched by his blessing, whether you know it or not. So I talked to Lama Kathy, and one of the papers that you've got there is a Guru Yoga, a very simple, short one, that he gave personally to her to teach. So we'll do a little bit of that together. And the other one is a prayer that comes out of the Karmakaju Nundro Guru Yoga that I particularly like. And I said, well, this is what I would like to do with this talk. And she wrote back, that's wonderful. We've been doing this multiple times a day for all 49 days. Who knew? So this is actually a copy of the PDF she sent me, complete with Chinese and Tibetan and something else. Maybe that's, I don't know, maybe you could tell me. Maybe one of those is Korean, I'm not sure. No, I don't know. But anyway, and of course, transliterated and translated in English. And so we'll be using that too in honor of Rinpoche. But before we get started, let's begin in the way we traditionally begin, with the four-line refuge prayer. Everything in Buddhism starts with refuge. There's no point in practicing Buddhism unless you actually have, in a very heartfelt way, an understanding that you need an umbrella. You need a refuge because it's raining. And you need the space to dry off and get a new relationship, an understanding of your relationship to how things are. So if you know the prayer, or you can read it on the sheets that were passed out and want to do it with me in Tibetan, that's great. If you don't, that's fine too. You can just follow along in your heart with an understanding that protection and teaching and companionship are all available, and you can come in out of the rain and enjoy those. Sanje Chudang Soki Choknam La Chang Chu Pardu Dakni Kyap Suchi Daki Jin So Yipe Sonam Ki Drola Pinshir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudong Soki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dak Ni Kyap Su Chi Dak Yi Jin So Yi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudong Soki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dak Ni Kyap Su Chi Dak Yi Jin So Yi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho. Thank you. So we do that three times. There's a lot of threes in Buddhism. We're going to get a couple more threes this morning. The first thing to understand about this is that this is a particularly Vajrayana approach to a relationship to a teacher. And Vajrayana works on multiple levels. We usually call them outer, inner, and secret. Once again, people get confused about what those are, so I'm going to just give you quick kind of understanding. In most cases, outer refers to our physical environment, people, the objects, the rituals that we do here, the ceremonies, the actions we take, both the sacred and the mundane actions. It's all outer. Inner is what our understanding and experience of those things are, and what it means, what the symbols mean. And secret refers to something ineffable. In Buddhism, it's called Tathagarbha, or Buddha nature. And that's the whole idea of a student-teacher relationship, is coming in contact with someone, somehow, even if it's not in person, which is possible. You can take Karmapa if you never met him in the outer way, or had an emotional relationship with him. You can have a deeper connection at this level because he's gained complete realization of this Buddha nature. As Lama Kathy says, when you get around, you have that same nature. It's one of the main and most important assumptions we make, is that you have the same nature that the Buddha has. It's not something you're going to get somewhere else. You've got it already. So call off the search if you're trying to get something. It's like you don't have to go anywhere. What you have to do is go inward. And what she says is that when you're around a person like that, it's like you're a tuning fork and they're a tuning fork and their tuning fork's already been struck. You don't have to even be struck. You just have to be around them. And if you're tuned to the same frequency, you'll also begin to vibrate at that level. You'll feel that. The interesting part for us is that that happens. We catch glimpses. They're precious. And then our minds go a little wacko. And a couple things may happen. We may forget that that's happening because it's already in us and say, oh, I want to get that again and again and again. And we start chasing around like somebody who is impoverished for this Buddha nature, doesn't have it. Or we can doubt it. We're very thoughtful. And doubt is like a big part of the American psyche. And as soon as that happens, we kind of fall out of that space and anxiety arises And then we can run away. This is what happens. Or, once again, put the search party back out there and spend all our energy going in the wrong direction. So we need a teacher, even if they're not physically present with us. We have to have the sense that we're being guided, that we're connected. That's the idea of Sangha. We have to have that because they're a little more consistent than we are. And we can get back around them and feel it again and do it again. And when we do this again and again, it really helps our minds to come to the place where we have this experience and we can rest in this experience. So what gets in our way? I mean, what's that all about? Well, one thing I have heard Rinpoche and other teachers as well say is, first of all, doubt is laziness. Doubt is worthless in the sense that worry is worthless. The remedy for doubt is finding stuff out. Find out how it really is. So if you're using doubt to push away, actually you need to understand that spiritually it's laziness. Nobody wants to be lazy. But we fall into it because we tell ourselves that it's really our intellect. We have good questions. Now, we may not seek out good answers. We'll just live with the questions and honor them and feel superior. There was a great Zen Roshi that I love so much, Suzuki Roshi. And he used to say that the most important mantra is don't know. And don't know is both knows, by the way, the K-N-O-W and the N-O. It's important that we come with openness. Usually our biggest obstacle is we come with conceptuality. In our culture in particular, we come with this idea that we've put all these things together and we really get it. Because when we look like we get it, we think everybody's going to like us. I was just telling Jeannie, I saw a commercial for some drug on TV, and they were driving around in Shelby Cobras, you know, like, and I said, boy, when I was a kid, that was the car, you know, and then these are all old guys, at least my age, you know, driving around who need heart medicine or something, right? And she said, well, what car would you want? And I said, oh, I don't know, just something that gets me from here to there. She said, what car would you want back then? I said, oh, any car that would make people like me. And she did what you did. She laughed. It's a really pathetic thing, but it's true. It's really true. So our conceptuality happens like this. This happened to me a lot. I'm actively militant against this thought process in my mind. I'm trying to change this habit. But I'll sit like in a Dharma talk. And I'll hear a talk on compassion. We talk about compassion a lot. Or, you know, loving kindness. Or something else we talk about a lot. And I'll just sit there and think, I know. Oh, I knew that. I knew that. Meanwhile, there's this person who's got their heart humming like a tuning fork, just wanting for mine to vibrate, and it's still in the box and can't be touched. And that box is, oh, I knew that. Or the even better one is, I knew he was going to say that. Meanwhile, there's a whole other level to tune into. I was just talking with Michael Stone about how many times we go through the beginning Buddhism classes or the preliminaries or the instructions for meditation. And if you're practicing Dharma properly, you can do that again and again for your whole life. And every time it's going to be new. Because you're new. there's this constant growth and change that is what the path is all about. And so it becomes really important to engender openness and to actively train our mind to open ourselves to blessing. And that's what Guru Yoga is all about. That's why we do it. Because naturally, we're going to run around thinking we know stuff, or run around, you know, trying to be attractive, or run around with all kinds of agendas that have nothing to do with awakening to the secret part, the part that's ineffable, where you're actually resonating in harmony with blessing, with love and compassion. So it's weird. We read a lot of books about it. I do. I got a lot of books. But honestly, I don't get much good out of them if I don't come with this open kind of attitude and be willing to go slow instead of read it fast and say, oh yeah, I read that book. See, it's the same thing. So when we do that, there's some kind of self-grasping underneath it. It's hard to train in this. And that's why the gift of Guru Yoga was given to us. It's why the gift of teachers were given to us. And they had to go through the very, very same thing. Every single one of them. Usually, many times, when somebody catches a glimpse of their own mind, maybe in the presence of a teacher, they'll either break out laughing, because the joke's always on us. It was there all the time. We just do everything in the world that we possibly can to keep it in the box, so to speak. Or we break down in crying because it's the most extraordinary moment of compassion that we ever felt. But it's a strong, strong energy that involves everything all together, both that inner space, how we understand things, and our actual experience of this person that we're with. So when we do Guru Yoga, we start with this idea of devotion. Okay, devotion. It's not the Temptation Song kind of devotion. The way it's usually presented in this way. Devotion starts with interest. Simply being interested and curious is a kind of devotion. Just being interested. So you're around the Dharma a little bit, and it feels a little like you're coming home or something. It feels like, oh, this is new and different, and yet it feels like home to me. I want to learn about this. That's good to be home. And that's interest. And so you start learning. You do some practice. You go to some classes. You start to really, that counts. That counts. And then there's longing. Once you get a sort of an understanding on your belt and you realize what the potential you have is, and it's an enormous potential, you have the potential to be a Buddha. For goodness sake, you long for that. Longing is also a kind of devotion. It's very important. It becomes the fuel that will take you down the path, and the path can be have a lot of requirements, and it can be difficult because we have a lot of mental projections and a lot of bad habits, even good habits, just a lot of habits to break in order to open up that box. And then lastly, there's confidence. Confidence is when you recognize how it all fits together and you've got it. So it's a little like you realize this has a taste of home. Then you realize you really want to get home. And then you realize you are at home. And once you're at home, you know, you can even get around in there with the lights off and actually get stuff done, you know, in the middle of the night. You're comfortable. you're relaxed, you really understand that space, and so on. So that's the feeling of devotion. It's not becoming a sycophant for some other human being, which is something that a lot of Americans mistake. And why do we mistake it that way? Well, in my case, it's because I want some authority figure to pat me on the head, tell me I'm good and I'm okay and I'm going the right direction. And now and then I get that. But that's not the really helpful part. Why else do we do it? Well, oh, you know, there's all the My Guru's Better Than Your Guru Club. Kathy Jackson, who sometimes sits in this seat, has had the great benefit of a lot of travel. She's been to India a few times and Tibet and so on. She told me once on some drive we were taking up to KTD. She's got a lot of stories, so she makes the drive shorter. And she was told me that she was there and she saw Dilgo Chensi Rinpoche, who when he was around, he was like, he was the guy. He was really the big axe in the world of Dharma worldwide. Just a huge, he was very much a living Buddha. And she saw him and went up to him and he just sort of recognized, I don't know, something great in her and gave her a hug. And I think she wanted to offer him a kata or something formal and he just gave her a hug and he looked in her eyes and said, who's your teacher? And she said, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. And he just wept. There's a whole bunch of levels to why he wept. He wept because she wasn't playing the my guru is better than your guru thing. She didn't have to say, even though she'd met the 16th Karmapa, Karmapa's my guru, or, you know, that thing. It's really important to recognize where our real resonance comes from. That's why we got to work on this unboxing routine, because it could be a lot of things and it could be a lot of different people. And it's something to be cherished and forget about the labels and the hierarchies and all that kind of stuff. There are great, great, great teachers who are absolutely hidden, absolutely hidden. And there are also great teachers who are kind of rock stars. Comes all kinds of different ways. The real question is as you, through your longing, are heading home, what do you find that really causes your heart to resonate and open? Because it's all about the openness. It's all about that. I think I said enough about all that. We'll run out of time. All right. So, to paraphrase the Mahamudra lineage prayer, devotion is our head. Our joyful effort is our strength. When you know you're heading for home, it's a happy thing, even if you've been on a great vacation. Joyful effort includes meditation and bodhicitta practices, visualizing different Buddhas and mantra recitation, because they're all designed to open the heart, and they're very skillful, and they will. And lastly, we end all our practices with dedication. And the dedication and aspiration prayers at the end are all kind of built around one thing. I dedicate this practice to awakening, that I would awaken for the benefit of all beings and that all beings would awaken and pass beyond suffering. It's that simple. So here's something I wrote about beginning guru yoga that I'm just going to read because I think it might be helpful. Mind is mental activity. The coming and going of thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Mind's nature is clear, open knowing, where thoughts, feelings, and sensations arise. Most of the time, we're caught up in thinking, feeling, and sensing, and we don't notice or honor the basic space within it, which it all arises. We don't honor the knowing, which is just there. So take a moment now and let your mind and body settle. Follow the breath as you breathe out. And at the end of the exhalation, just rest. The breath will continue on its own. And that's the point. Just follow it out and rest, and you'll still be breathing. If you do this a few times a day, if you do this right now, you may find a little contact with that inner space of knowing. It's often described as the space of all phenomena, or sunlight in a cloudless sky. It has no center, it has no edge. It's just lit up space. And there comes a thought. There goes a thought. This is shamatha. We begin every single practice like this. It's really, really important that we do this for a little bit of time every day, no matter what else we might do. It's great if we can do it several times a day. You only have to take a few moments to do it. In order to experience it, though, we can play around with our minds because, you know, we get busy and it's tough to let go and all of that. So try this. I'm going to make a noise with this gong here. Now pay attention, not to the sound, but to the hearing of the sound. Ask yourself, where is the experience of hearing? Just look around inside yourself. See if you can find the experience of hearing. Is it inside? Is it outside? Is it somewhere in between? Where would it be? It's hard to locate the experience of hearing. It is just there. And then it isn't there. It doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't go anywhere. Yet it just comes and goes. That's how things are. This luminous awareness, this knowing space, is always there. whatever our eyes, our nose, our ears, our sense of touch, no matter what our senses bring us, they arise there like the weather, and then they go away. So the idea of Guru Yoga is that we start with some kind of supplication, some kind of asking, some longing, and then we receive a blessing. And first we get a blessing of the body, because actually, you know, we're embodied. Here we are. It's the thing that actually holds all the machines that provide conduits from the world into our inner self. So there's the objects of seeing, the organs of seeing, our eyes, and then the experiences we have that arise based on all kinds of things, the condition of our mind mostly. And all of that arises all at once, all together, in this space of knowing. So first the guru blesses the body, and we visualize that as white light coming from between his eyes and entering us between our eyes, just filling us, purifying everything, every tension, every obstacle, every bit of ourselves that we don't love, every bit of ourselves that we do love, all of it, just washing it all away and leaving it open and relaxed. And then comes the blessing of speech. They call it the blessing of speech. Really, speech is the way that we relate to one another. And so therefore, it's the blessing of relationships, how we relate to ourselves, what our self-talk is, how we relate to the world and each other. And of course, we get into a lot of trouble because we're not good at relationships. And so there's the blessing of speech. And it comes as a red light from the guru's throat to our throat. And then lastly, there's the blessing of mind, which is like a blue light that really is a luminous, open, empty light that goes from the guru's heart to our heart. And that's the part that we resonate with. It's how our hearts are the same. That's how we're one. And lastly, all three lights come together. Because frankly, everything is together in this. The devotion isn't separate, sequential movements of interest, longing, and confidence. They come together. They empower one another. And all these purifications and blessings come together because we're an expression of non-dual being desiring to wake up. And in the end, there's a dissolution. At this point, you can look at what you are. You may experience your heart in the heart of the guru, or the guru's heart in your heart. without any particular, what do we call it, mixing, like water poured into water. You can't get them apart, connected like that. And when you pose the question at that point, what am I? When you pose that question, conceptual thinking stops. It's not about what am I experiencing anymore. It's about what am I? And when you look, you really don't see anything. However, it's also not simply nothing. It's this clear, empty knowing. You're now identified with this open space within which all of life unfolds. And then you rest. And you dedicate the merit of the practice. And when you get off the cushion after that, you're changed a little bit. You're a little more confident that you are engendering that which you long for and that which is home, your real home. There's a great physicist who wrote a book called, Stuart Kaufman was his name, he wrote a book called At Home in the Universe. This is like an experiential practice to help us train our minds to come to not just a knowledge of being at home in the universe, that we are at home in the universe, but a real felt experience of that. So that's how I see Guru Yoga. And frankly, it's like a main practice for me every day. There are a lot of different Guru Yogas that you can do. And I would say, so be curious and look at a lot of them to see which one you like the best. Pretty much all the Yidam practices are Guru Yogas too, if you think about it, the way they go. So maybe it's Chenrezig practice. They all are based on the same thing. The point is that it's all there in us, and we just have to train our mind to allow ourselves to directly experience it. I found a quote from H.L. Mencken, who is a funny guy, that seems to apply to this in some way. He said, "Penetrating so many secrets, we cease to believe in the unknowable. But there it sits, nevertheless, calmly licking its chops." So when we do this, we don't worry about this animal licking its chops. We befriend the animal, and he lets us back in the house, you know, which is where we've always wanted to be. So it's a quarter after. I'd like to do two things. I'd like to do this Guru Yoga together. And then for the dedication, use this prayer. The Lama Rinpoche Ma. So let's just read this together, starting with the third paragraph. You begin by visualizing the Lama above your head or in front of you. He should be visualized as totally insubstantial. Even if the Lama is visualized in his ordinary form, he should not be conceived of as being solid form of flesh and blood. He should be visualized as being made of light rays, and light as the embodiment of the compassion and wisdom of all Buddhas. Then you pray, either using a specific practice liturgy or simply whatever you wish to say. You might be praying for wisdom, or you might be using the practice to reveal something or confess something that's bothering you. In any case, you pray. Then at the end of it, you take the first three empowerments in the form of white rays of light from the guru's forehead to your forehead, and red rays of light from the guru's throat to your throat, and blue rays of light from the guru's heart to your heart. When that happens, you think that all of the obscurations of the three doors, body, speech, and mind, are purified and removed. Then finally, the three lights come at the same time, which is the fourth empowerment. Following that, you think that the Lama melts into light and dissolves into you, and that this mind and your mind are mixed like water being poured into water. This is effective if you have the confidence that the visualized Lama is the embodiment of wisdom of all the Buddhas and not something solid made of flesh and blood. Though mixing your mind with the Guru's, or through mixing your mind with the Guru's, the qualities that are characteristics of the Guru's mind will start to manifest in yours. So if I can make a recommendation, that's obviously a brief and simple practice. I like them brief and simple. If you took 5 minutes every day to do that little shamatha practice, just to calm down and open up, and then did this simple guru yoga, I mean, literally, it could be 5 minutes. If you do it every day, it'll change your life. I guarantee very few things in this world, but I can guarantee that. So, it's 20 after. I don't know if there are any questions. I know I just kind of like went through a lot of stuff there. But please use the question mic if you have anything, any comment you want to make or any questions you want to make. What about... Oh, Jamie has a question about the first paragraph. Can you go to the mic and say it? Oh, well, tell me what it is and I'll repeat it.
What does the withdrawal phase of the Dharma practice mean? And are we supposed to do something right before this?
Well, when the withdrawal phase of sadhana practice. So the first paragraph is, Maha Mudra can first be practiced in the context of the withdrawal phase of sadhana practice, and especially through the approach of mixing your guru's mind and your mind. So the withdrawal phase is, you know, when you're doing a sadhana, you're kind of starting where you are. And then you're calming your mind, which is letting go of some of the discursive thinking. So you're withdrawing from your normal discursive thinking, right? And you start to get used to the space between the thoughts, the space behind the thoughts, and just letting the thoughts come and go. So it's a matter of where we put our energy, and we're withdrawing our energy from the discursive and allowing it to rest in the spaciousness within which it all arises. Okay? So whether you're doing shamatha or whether you're doing chenrezig or whether you're doing guru yoga, that withdrawal phase is that cultivating the mind that lets go. Okay? That's the way I understand it. And then this guru yoga is a step-by-step process for mixing your mind with the mind of the guru, which is helpful in starting to get a more harmonious, consistent sense of this harmony and this resonance that I was talking about, and not being so distracted by what comes and goes. Does that make sense? That's why I did the coming and going thing with the gong. This is all of this is a very skillful path to help us to directly experience for ourselves this awakening to our own true nature, our own Buddha nature. That's what this is. That's what Mahamudra is. And so it all goes together in that way. Even the empowerments, if I could say one more thing, even the empowerments, you start with your body and all and everything. I mean, all experience, the mountains, the skies, the oceans, the rivers, the seas, all that outside. You start with that because your body is what brings that to mind, right? All your senses. And first you purify that and you think you've started with the biggest thing. And then you go to the next empowerment, your speech, which I contend is our relationship with all of that that arises for us. Well, gee, that's actually even more, that's in some sense bigger, because it doesn't exist in the way it exists without that. And then lastly, we open up to the spaciousness within which all of that exists. So as you go in and in and in, you're actually not going from large to small. You're going from everything to more and more. And it's a way of directly experiencing infinite awareness. Does that make sense? So this is like, that's what he's saying. It's like, okay, at this phase of practice, we can do this, and it'll help us make this step into awareness. Does that help? Or is that confusing? Okay, good. Anything else? One question a day, huh? Okay. So it's dedication. This is one of my favorite prayers of all time. It's not my favorite translation, but what can you do? This is actually the one they've been using up at Carmel Ling, so we'll go with it. And you read it from right to left, by the way. It's not like all the way down the left side and then down the right side. It's like marching left, right, left, right. I supplicate the precious Guru. Grant your blessing that fixation on a self be abandoned by the mind. Grant your blessing that independence arise in our continuums. Grant your blessing that non-dharmic thoughts cease. Grant your blessing that I realize my mind to be unborn. Grant your blessing that confusion be pacified in its own place. Grant your blessing that all that appears and exists be realized to be the Dharmakaya. I think just within that, you can hear pretty much everything I said It's like, this prayer is like Prego spaghetti sauce. It's in there. So we dedicate the merit of this gathering this morning to our own awakening and the awakening of all beings. May kindness and compassion, safety, health, and happiness abound. Soha. Yeah, do this one more time. So don't listen to it. Find the hearing. It's really cool to try to do that.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.